Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Hello, I'm Gavin Titley, and I'm Professor of Media Studies in Maynooth University in Ireland.
And it's a great pleasure to have Maynooth represented and to have Prof. Titley here, who has just dedicated a quarter of an hour of his life to therapizing me.
The quarter of an hour well spent, but the listenership can't access it, so.
But thank you so much, Gavin, for being with us. It's great to see you, apart from anything else. Looking well, looking reasonably happy. I mean, happy, but I have to say reasonably because who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. Share with us, if you would, Prof, what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
It's a great question, and also the relationship, I suppose, between those, what's dynamizing, retarding, and interesting. I mean, I think it would be remiss of me in some way to not start with what's obviously happening in Gaza, because I think, I mean, there's many ways of thinking about this, but I was recently struck by a phrase that Naomi Klein used in an article on Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, where she talked about an idea of kind of ambient genocide, that humanitarian or human violence that should stop us in our tracks, that should overturn everything, that should mobilize us. And yet, while people are mobilizing, of course, and while people are doing everything they can to stop this, it's happening in ways that are hyper transparent. It's happening in ways that is drip fed and mediated into our daily lives. And I think that that provides a backdrop which is deeply troubling for any of us who want to stop it, but for any of us who think about media and politics as well. I think that's something that's deeply, deeply, deeply disturbing at the moment, that this is not just happening in plain sight, but this notion of ambience that Klein talks about, that it suffuses the everyday and the news feed and the daily grind and the daily nonsense of university life and everything else like that just continues as if this isn't happening to fellow human beings. So
Indeed.
sorry, Toby,
Go
go
ahead.
ahead.
Yeah. No, please
So,
proceed.
I mean, I don't want to make an artificial sort of segue from thinking about the backdrop of that to what might preoccupy me in academic terms. But I think there are some kinds of connections, because one of the things that has struck me about the transparency and the ambient way in which this genocide has been prosecuted is the sheer centrality of a certain kind of politics of noise to it, which is that we all know what's happening, and we all know what is being done to Palestinians in Gaza, and also, of course, in the West Bank. But the kind of media spectacle, the day-to-day thresholds that people are expected to sort of pass to be able to speak the truth about what's happening are not in any ways sort of presented as substantive arguments. They're presented as ways of occupying political time and space. They're sort of modes of political noise that you need to pay fealty to this, you need to recognize this, you need to apparently recognize the ambivalence of this, that, and the other to be able to talk about an unfolding genocide. And it's a kind of way of doing politics and a way of thinking about the public sphere that I've been starting to think about in relation to work I've been doing on the concept, or more accurately, public understandings of the idea of freedom of speech, which is a kind of a theme which I've come to in my work almost kind of accidentally over the last few years. But it's one where I'm really interested in thinking about the ways in which contemporary debates about freedom of speech are actually ways of resetting the public space, of resetting the public sphere, of expressing certain kinds of conflicts about who can speak and in what ways they can speak in the public sphere. And one of the things that I'm interested in, the way in which freedom of speech is being talked about nowadays, is that it's talked about as a notion that's sort of preserved in aspic. It's talked about in terms which are taken from the 18th and 19th century, which in many ways just do simply not admit of the significant changes in our societies, politics, but also, of course, in our communicative and informational environments. And so the ways in which speech actually functions, so for example, the sort of the way in which political noise is used to sort of occupy time and space in democracy, is sort of left out of the picture when we talk about freedom of speech, as speech which is free is one of the ways in which we enact democracy. People are informed, people get to make choices, people get to be part of the formation of public reason and so on. So there seems to me to be an interesting sort of split between the ways in which freedom of speech, which has become such a central preoccupation, is talked about and the actual conditions. And I don't mean to be too crudely reductionist in making that distinction, but the actual conditions of politics and the public sphere, which are very, very different. And where if we start to think about it, speech doesn't achieve a lot of the things that we sort of assume, often in this kind of folksy sort of wisdom around freedom of speech, that we assume that it can achieve or should achieve.
I'm thinking in historic terms, 20 odd years ago, Prof, and when I felt like I was one of millions around the world chanting things like "the people cannot be defeated" in opposition to the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. But I knew, of course, that the people would be defeated without a doubt. And the exercise of speech in opposition to that imperialism might be feasible, would happen, but would mean absolutely nothing. In terms of bourgeois media coverage, by and large, but more particularly in terms of public policy. And of course, there are other occasions one can think of when that made a difference. But as with Gaza, where opinion is clearly opposed to what Israel, the state of Israel, is doing, in vast majorities of the world, it matters little. It's had minimal impact. Now, much more than it did when the US was embarked on its own imperial adventure. But it has achieved very little. And of course, part of that is to do with something that perhaps you're hinting at, which is that the major organs of policy influence in the imperial powers are not very interested in this. They're interested in the question of what goes on, but they're not interested in their nation states' complicitness and opposition within the public.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I know you had it's one of the I've listened to many of the podcasts, not just in preparation for this, but also because it's such an interesting cast of contributors that you have. And I saw there was one recently with Jody Dean, which I haven't had a chance to listen to, but I was always very struck by the argument in her book, Democracy, you know, neoliberalism and Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies, rather, where she makes the argument about this sort of understanding the difference between the sort of exchange value and the use value of communication in democratic terms. So on the one hand, we sort of invest, particularly thinking through the public sphere tradition, but not only, also thinking about, you know, the very instrumentality of our speech and our actions. We invest it with a certain kind of exchange, with a certain kind of use value, right? We're going to understand each other. We're going to develop common ideas. We're going to speak truth to power. We're going to have an influence on this policy or whatever it might be. And yet what she saw starting to take shape under those particular media and political conditions, which I thought was very prescient, was that so much communication is actually about exchange value. It's about its flow through the securities and networks of media and information and so on. And I think the argument that she was making from that sort of, you know, transparency, all of these ideas that we associate with some of the kind of classical, not just liberal democratic, but centrally liberal democratic assumptions about how public opinion is formed and the kinds of impacts that it can have on the distribution of political power and the exercise of political power are, as she pointed out, to a certain differing perhaps in different contexts, but are to a large extent fantastical. And I think that's something that we've seen, or at least that's something that I'm interested in looking at through the ways in which this notion of freedom of speech has become incredibly important to the sort of performance of Western democracy at precisely a moment when Western democracies are going through something of a kind of authoritarian turn, or where they are very, very keen in many instances to we've been talking about Palestine, so clearly we can look at that example, to if not always overtly repress, but to make public protest, public mobilization of any kind very difficult, to make the expression of political opinions when those protests are allowed to happen under often very circumscribed terms, to make the expression of actual politics very, very different, to make the expression of politics around something like Gaza in university spaces, to make that very difficult, up to and including criminalizing it or turning it into an offense in different institutions. So there's what I'm trying to look at, or to go to kind of riff on the question of what perturbs me and interests me right now, is why certain sort of liberal and democratic notions have become so central to the sort of mediation of where, inverted commas, our democracies are at moments where we can see real assaults on freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of expression in all kinds of ways. But I can go round on this a little bit later. But one of the ways I think which this happens, and which I'm most interested in, is that the speech which is prohibited, or the speech which is proscribed, or the speech which is marginalized, is prohibited or marginalized by being defined as something other than speech. So there's something going on here as well, which is beyond hypocrisy. And I'm very interested in getting beyond the idea that states are hypocritical or anything like that, and rather looking at that what happens is that certain forms of speech get prescribed by being redefined as different kinds of acts that are therefore no longer forms of speech that can aspire to be considered freedom of speech. So, for example, a march in London in favor of a ceasefire can be redesignated, or a swell of Braverman before she had to resign, attempted to redesignate it as a hate march. Student protests in Germany have been redesignated as sort of assaults on the constitutional order of the state. Public order, radicalization, all of these kinds of ideas are being used to narrow the space and to narrow the possibilities through which democratic action and freedom of expression can take place, precisely at moments where states are saying we're doing this in order to defend particular democratic settlements which have these values which we hypermediate, which include centrally freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
One of the things that I find ironic is that I'm repeatedly reading in the international bourgeois press that there are more elections this year than any other year in history or any other year in living memory or whatever, which one might imagine would be cause for celebration by these people, but it's not, because they're almost universally, uniformly terrified by the expression of popular will, particularly if the popular will is authoritarian and right-wing, which is not what these organs of capitalism want. That actually doesn't work for them in lots of ways. In some ways, those things do, but in other ways, they really don't. And they also may offend their liberal sensibilities. You know, I'm thinking of the ideal reader of The Economist, for example, as a place that is, you know, pro-environment, pro-gender equality, pro-marriage equality, anti-racism, pro-immigration, anti-dictatorship, and hates us with an incredible passion, right? But really hates the crazy right, because that's more worrying to them than we, in inverted commas, are. So, Prof, I wondered if you could explain to us a little more a rather enigmatic remark you made about, to the effect that you've almost found yourself caught up in questions of free speech without having decided to go there. It's almost overtaken you rather than being one of these research issues that burns within and you must engage. I found that really interesting. I wonder if you could take us back to where this emerges for you as an issue and why it's become so significant.
Yeah, I think it's really good to pick up on that, because it's something that it's something that I continually ask myself in certain moments, despairing versions of the question as well as more enthusiastic versions of that question. I think I need to identify a couple of different starting points. And one of the things that I found interesting in starting to think about this question more expansively is to look at the disciplines where there are kind of live discussions around freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and so on. And one of the things which is striking to an extent is that, you know, in our shared discipline around media and communications, there's very little literature. I mean, there's obviously some literature in terms of communication regulation. There's more mentions of the First Amendment and freedom of speech when you come to certain North American literatures and so on. But you would never go really to, you know, one of the big international conferences and find entire panels or sections which are dedicated to thinking about freedom of speech, freedom of expression. for a number of reasons, but I think one of those reasons is that when we, in disciplinary terms, think about speech and think about communication, we can't do so outside of infrastructures. We can't do so outside of thinking about media and mediums. We can't do so outside of thinking about relations. And this troubles, if you like, the orthodox ways in which freedom of speech is often discussed, which is that because primarily its inheritance in the way that it's talked about in public discussion comes in terms of legal challenges. So what are specific thresholds which exist for legitimate speech? When does speech cross over a particular threshold from speech which can be legitimately free into some form of incitement or hate speech or whatever it might be? So there are questions of speech which are about sort of legitimacy and limits, which, you know, descend from law to a large extent. Then there are also questions about sort of what is good speech or virtuous speech or bad speech, which are more vested in moral philosophy, maybe political philosophy to a certain extent. But then the notion is sort of absent from lots of other disciplines. It's also, I read something really interesting essay recently in the Cambridge Online Encyclopedia of Anthropology, which was making the point that anthropologists never write about freedom of speech, because for them, the idea when you study, for example, kinship relationships, the idea that you can have speech which is either defined as free or unfree is obviously a nonsense, because all forms of speech, when they're in embodied relationships, when they're in generational relationships, when they're in patriarchal relationships, institutional relationships, whatever it might be, all forms of speech are neither simply free or unfree, but are subject to lots of different forms of perhaps coercion or closure or foreclosure on what can be said, but also openings and possibilities and so on. But they went on in this essay to make the point that for all of that, when you look across sort of anthropological literatures of speech, there's certainly a sense in which speech as a sort of, you know, mode of human flourishing is very, very important to people culturally, socially, politically, and so on, which I think in many ways is kind of obvious. So one of the things that I have become interested in is why, to cut short this sort of disciplinary sort of exegesis, is why when we talk about freedom of speech is so much of the discussion about freedom and so little about speech. In other words, so little about communication and its complexities, which I think there's two elements of that which I find interesting. One is that it's very difficult to understand freedom without thinking about particular notions of speech, right? Without being specific about speech, without being contextual, because the idea of speech as a sort of totality of communication is just not something that we sort of live as speakers or communicators of with different abilities to speak and communicate, who speak and communicate in different sorts of formal and informal settings and so on and so forth. And that's before we even bring media into the picture. And then when we do bring media and communications into the picture, we're obviously talking about the transformation of speech and communication in all kinds of ways and in accelerated ways over the last few years as well. So one of the things that I have found had become interesting to me is why at a moment when we think about contemporary politics, we think about the contemporary public sphere, and we talk about the sort of historically unprecedented density and abundance of communications, inverted commas, speech, our discussions of freedom of speech almost remain untouched by these conditions of communication and speech production and speech circulation. So that's one thing that I want to bring together those two sides, or those two elements, in looking at the ways in which freedom of speech is problematized in a lot of places and in a lot of discussions right now. The other aspect of it, I suppose, and this was my starting point, is something that I wrote about in a book a few years ago, is free speech racist, was to look at the ways in which the notion of freedom of speech is not just appropriated in some sort of tactical or superficial level, but that the weaknesses in the way that freedom of speech is often thought about and talked about produce political openings and produce often deeply reactionary political openings. So one of the things that I was very interested in was how a particular relationship between the articulation of racisms today and freedom of speech had developed over the last few years. And one of those things that I looked at, as I already mentioned, was this relationship between a sort of, to put a very blunt but not entirely accurate dating on it, but a sort of a post 9/11 authoritarian approach to speech, protest, surveillance, information, which went hand in hand with the kind of civilizational politics that celebrated in increasingly often sort of, you know, full-throated terms the status of the West as the home of liberal democracy, which celebrates particular defining values, including freedom of speech. And so that, in that book, I wanted to look at this, as I said, not as a form of hypocrisy, but as a political process whereby certain forms of speech simply were redesignated as certain kinds of acts. So I'm thinking of the Prevent agenda, for example, in Britain. I'm thinking of the whole rake of security legislation, which was brought in France in 2015, first of all, after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and then later on that year after the November attacks, which was an event which sacralized freedom of speech as a central value of the Republic, at the same time as political speech was criminalized, but political speech was also surveyed and problematized in a whole range of ways in different institutions. So I suppose to try to sum that up a little bit, what I started with was a kind of, or how I got interested in looking at this notion, was an impatience at the way in which it had been appropriated, and particularly the ways in which it was appropriated by the far right, and we can talk a bit more about this maybe, to create political space, essentially to bring back forms of racist argumentation and racist discourse, which had been defeated politically, which had been pushed out of political space. But by appealing to freedom of speech, they were able to bring these back as sort of propositions that just need to be debated. And the second, I suppose, the aspect that I've gone on to look at then is to try to think about this a little bit more systematically outside of that sort of, you know, political essay that I wrote, and to really try to trouble this question as to why there's so much discussion about freedom of speech that doesn't connect with the conditions under which speech is being produced and circulated today.
And getting on to that topic, Prof, I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, and freedom was an incredibly important concept to me. I can still remember finishing in the mid-1970s my public exams that finished high school, and running across the quadrangle, which was against school rules, and doing so, tearing apart a bit of my uniform with the buttons coming off, not deliberately tearing them apart, but doing so, and going through my head, "I'm free" by The Who. And that notion, however adolescent, didn't leave me until I spent decades living in the United States, where freedom represented right-wing bourgeois individualism, racism, and hatred of the other, and above all, evangelical Christianity designed to damn anybody different. And so the word freedom, the word liberty, became almost anathematic to me, even though, of course, they matter. I believe in freedom of movement. I believe in freedom of association. I don't believe in incarceration, right? All those things. But for me, that whole logic was occupied terrain, occupied by the right. And it also seems to me that in terms of arguments about infrastructure of communication, those arguments, traditionally the scene of the left, right? Look at the bourgeois media, look at state media. They don't listen to us. They don't care about us, right? That also is occupied terrain, occupied by the right, arguing that the BBC is a kind of left-wing conspiracy when all the content analysis shows that it swings to the right, arguing that the major networks in the United States, CBS, NBC, ABC, are occupied by liberals, and probably the journalists are liberal, but what they produce assuredly isn't. And, of course, the appropriation of Gramscian politics of the spectacle by the right. So what was January 6th, 2021, but a kind of left-wing politics of the spectacle borrowed by the right, at the end of which the left was damning this kind of seditious conduct, claiming that the freedom of speech rights that Donald J. Trump supposedly used were actually not, should not be considered protected speech because they were encouraging seditious behavior. So I find myself turned around intellectually and above all emotionally by the appropriation of these beloved concepts, not so much by media organs, but by a populist right that is driven as much probably by think tanks in its distribution of its madness and by an organic, sometimes proletarian endorsement.
Yeah, there's a lot there, isn't there? What can I say after that? Because again, you know, I find myself in I find myself in complete agreement. I mean, I think the to pick apart some aspects of it, I think that the one of the things that you mentioned there around the sort of infrastructures of communication is a very interesting example of just how embedded this rhetoric around a particular notion of freedom, which we'll come to, but the utility of freedom of speech as a way of enacting that in public space has become. So as you point out, I mean one of the things that I was at a discussion of public service broadcasting recently, and it's a line that I've heard before, and I kind of understand where the attraction to it, but one of the sort of defenders of almost the inevitable crapness of current public service broadcasting was saying, look, we're attacked from the left and we're attacked from the right, so we must be doing something right. So it's like, you know, the kind of empty pleasing structuralism, which means that the actual content of the criticisms doesn't need to get engaged with. But that's one of the examples, I think, of the kind of confusion which is created not just by the appropriation of terms and language at this level, but by the sort of positionality that it produces as well. So if you take it beyond the sort of criticism of the BBC, if you think of the way that GB News is positioning itself at the moment, right, which is endlessly daring Ofcom to actually regulate it, and may become part of a much bigger media conglomeration now with the Telegraph and so on and so forth. One of the things that GB News say is that we're actually bringing the pluralism. So they, you know, they appropriate the idea of pluralism by saying, look, the BBC represents the left, the BBC represents all of these things. And if you didn't have us, you wouldn't have pluralism. And you've told us that pluralism is what you actually want. And you get the same in France, for example, with many of the sort of channels of the Bolloré group who present themselves as pluralist chains and again dare the French regulator
authorities.
to.
Could I just step in there for a
Yeah,
second
of course.
off to explain
Yeah.
a couple of things to listeners? The plurality
Sure.
of whom is in the United States, they're not the majority. So Ofcom is like the Federal Communications Commission in the
Yes.
US, the regulatory body in Britain. And GB News is a far-right TV, so-called news outlet, where even news programs are hosted by sitting congresspeople, by conservative members of parliament, in ways that clearly run counter to the rules about the separation of the presentation of news, meant to be the work of journalism, from the appearance by politicians, clearly counter to Ofcom's rules. Ofcom's belatedly wagged a tiny finger, but this hasn't meant much. And The Spectator, which the prof mentioned, it's interesting because this goes back to the so-called origins of the public sphere, was a lively bourgeois organ of political critique centuries ago in London, run by merchants who were slavers,
Yes.
and is now the, in a sense, weekly intellectual outlet of the right, but not the far right, more the sort of basis of the Conservative Party. It is now up for sale. And it is possible and becoming increasingly likely that it will be taken over by the Brexit-supporting multi-millionaire Tory who bankrolls GB News. And I say bankrolls because it's worth people realizing that these things are in no sense profitable. They are
Exactly.
vanity affairs ordered by the far right. So sorry to interrupt, Prof, just to give a
No,
bit of
no, no,
context.
no, no. These were more than necessary footnotes, I would say, Toby, to precisely, you know, the context of the discussion. I would add it. I was just about to add a parallel there in terms of concentration in French media, where again you have a large group owned by a very comparable figure in terms of a fidelity to hard right politics, a propensity to like to see that politics represented in the editorial line of the media that he owns. So this Bolloré group has cross media holdings, including again sort of quite large, not particularly profitable but popular television channels, where again it's a steady diet of course. What we see here also is the shift from, you know, one of the things that all of these channels do is they dare the regulators to say that what they're doing is not news, right? Because they have to produce a certain percentage of news. But what they will do is argue that we're commenting on the news, and therefore that constitutes current affairs, constitutes the news. But what they're doing, of course, is simply pumping out opinion, an opinion of a certain kind, opinion where the same kind of guests, you can substitute these from the North American imagination, very, or from a gallery of characters, very, very, very sort of accurately. Steve Bannon, et cetera, et cetera. These are the kinds of people you would see on these channels. And they're daring the regulators, and they're daring the public service broadcasters, and they're daring others to say, We're the Democrats. We're bringing the pluralism. If you attack us, if you shut us down, you're actually against all the things that you've been telling us for decades, you've been standing for. So the question you're asking, Toby, is a good one, is how do we understand the not just the sort of appropriation at the level of discourse, but the appropriation at a certain level of sort of credibility, affect, the way that this seems to make sense. And I think one of the things, if we think about those examples, one of the things that you get on something like GB News and one of the things you get on CNews in France is a steady diet of people telling you that others are stealing your enjoyment. Others are the thieves of your enjoyment. It's migrants, it's trans people, it's women, it's feminists, it's ecologists, it's whoever they are. And it's not just they're stealing your enjoyment and stopping you from accessing the good life. They actually constitute a hegemony. They constitute an elite.
Yes.
They constitute a power block, and they victimize you, or you will be their victims unless you have intermediaries like us who are brave enough to stand up for the majority.
Well, you know, Javier Milei, the new Argentine president,
yes,
gave a talk last week in which he invoked Gramsci.
Yes.
And said that the Gramscian notion of the war of position has been successfully waged by the left across cultural politics in Argentina for decades. We must stand against this and defeat it together. And piece by piece, we will unpick what the 19th century German socialists called the long march of the institutions. This stuff is becoming absolutely clear to them, and they are again and again appropriating the vocabulary of the left to make these points.
Yeah.
I mean, that, I think is the sort of frightening thing for me. Right.
I think it's deeply frightening. But I think the tactics are certainly the war of position. But I think it's the effective register of this politics is what brings us back to this sort of the problem of freedom, which is the historically, of course, a certain mode of victimhood is always a central to nationalist mobilization, because you know it's always something external or a problem within or an enemy within which is stopping the unique genius of the ethnos from being expressed. But what you get reproduced, and I think this is where the media stream and the politics come together, is you get this sort of reproduction of thieves of the good life, which kind of can change rapidly. So if you look at sort of studies of media content in the UK and elsewhere over the last while, after the Black Lives Matter protests and uprisings, there was a brief period in British media where media on the right and part of the right of the Tory party tried to make critical race theory the enemy, but it just didn't take root. So one of the things is, as well, is these projections, these obsessions, these sort of objects which are being presented for, I suppose, as kind of enjoyable objects of aversion, right? Like this, you can enjoy the fact that this thing is coming to get you and we're going to stop it. Sometimes they don't work. And so they turn their attention to trans people. That's what they've been doing ever since. And that has worked to a large extent for them. So there's always a search, not just for position, but a search for producing this kind of object of aversion, that thing which is preventing you from being free. And I think it's partly this then which produces this rhetoric around freedom. It's not freedom which is a collective project. It's not freedom which is a universalist project, obviously. It's not even freedom which is a relational project. It's freedom which is freedom from a whole series of restraints which are being arbitrarily I'm being arbitrarily subjected to. And those restraints are being produced and produced and mediated through these new kind of sort of channels in the ecosystem, which have no other purpose other than to create this kind of content. And I think they're also, as we can see when we look at the example I was giving, they're also a kind of a strange mix of old media power, if you like, in terms of like conglomerates that acquire cross-media holdings and then go on to take a particular sort of political positioning in the public sphere and in the democracy. But they're also, of course, part of the new media ecosystem where there's a lot of space for YouTube influencers and others to occupy disproportionate kind of power within these networks. And I don't think we've somehow, you know, when we still think of this sort of the spectrum, the political spectrum of left to right and the media spectrum of left to right, I don't think we've quite come to terms with these sort of new integrated ecosystems in which the hard right, which is looking for more mainstream coverage, and the center right, which is moving to the far right because that's where, you know, that's where divisiveness is going to pay off for them. That's where the sort of rich material is for them to sort of stoke up various forms of popular fear. I don't think we've come to grips with just how sort of potentially problematic that is going to be over the next few years, particularly given, you know, where we started, the lack of interest really in regulators in dealing with this. But I think just to try to capture what that means, I think is the reason that freedom is so hard to reclaim is not just discursive. It's that it's been constantly produced as a state which can be achieved if only these arbitrary, you know, restraints of wokeness and equality or whatever it might be that day could be sort of could be removed from me. And I think this is where I'm very persuaded by the argument of a book called Todd McGowan's book, Enjoyment, Right and Left. I think you'd have a really good conversation with him, where he makes the point that, you know, all of this emphasis on fact checking, all of this emphasis on finding ways of correcting disinformation and what's going on in the public sphere hasn't reckoned with this question of jouissance, of enjoyment, that one of the things that's being offered here, when no positive political program is on offer from almost anybody, is forms of enjoyment. And I think that that's a very, you know, we don't want to be too reductive with that either, but it's a very important insight, I think, to understanding the ways in which freedom is not just sort of discursively captured, but has been captured at this sort of, you know, affective positional level.
And one of the concepts you've raised there, Prof, is nationalism. And I wonder if you could expound on that a bit. It's something you've written about a lot, and its relation to multiculturalism, its relationship to racism, its relationship to the media, and maybe situate some of this in the context of the countries where you've lived and taught. So you could explain it to us at a theoretical conceptual level, but also at the level of the places that you know.
I mean, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about nor taught much on the question of the politics of multiculturalism for some time. But one of the things that I've noticed in Britain over the last few weeks is a return to a discourse of this, and this time it's in relation to the current context, where there's an attempt to, if not criminalize, as an attempt to demonize pro-Palestinian political activism. There's an attempt to position it as an expression of Islamic radicalism. And in attempting to position it as an expression of Islamic radicalism, it allows the return of a certain kind of politics, which was very, very live in the early 2000s, existed before that, but was obviously given a particular electric shock after 9/11, but also after the London bombings and so on and so forth, which is to sort of produce a version of the nation which says the problem is that we've been too good, we've been too tolerant, we've been too generous, we've respected cultural difference, we've allowed, it used to be the idea that we've allowed these ghettos and we've allowed these sorts of cultural practices to flourish without insisting that people sign up to the most minimum of liberal values. That's all we're asking for. Now it is something which has had several more years of being marinated in the sort of anti-radicalization discourse. And so it's the idea that we've allowed these kinds of politics to sort of incubate. And therefore we need to go back to insisting on a sort of minimum, you know, a minimum threshold of acceptance of who the nation is and what our values are. And so One of the ways in which I think nationalism is being reproduced at the moment, there are many ways in which nationalism is constantly being reproduced, but one of the most reliable ways in which it is reproduced is to position it as a sort of necessary corrective to the generosity, the over-tolerance, the sort of naive cosmopolitanism of imagined versions of what the nation was. And you can see this in I can give a kind of number of examples of that. When I started looking at this sort of explosion of discourse about the problem of multiculturalism in the 2000s, and I wrote a book with Alain de Lenton called The Crisis of Multiculturalism. And one of the things that struck us, it wasn't exactly what we started out to look at, but one of the things that struck us was that, you know, when we did sort of more empirical work on certain contexts, this idea that there was actually a coherent, legal or policy-enabled era of multiculturalism just simply never really existed. So you can have multicultural crises in countries that never had anything that would even resemble or could be parlayed as a series of multicultural policies. Now, of course, what constitutes multicultural policy, how you would define that is tricky. But the simple point remains, there was a concerted production of an idea that problems in European cities, problems with political extremism, problems with, you know, what problems on the street could be understood as a policy failure that now needed to be undone. And what we argued was that this was a sort of a generative mechanism for a nationalism which couldn't return to openly chauvinistic or openly ethnocentric or openly integralist ways of understanding citizenship or understanding the nation, because of course capitalist economies are open, they are globalized, they are dependent on being able to exploit migrant labor in different ways, and therefore they were interested in not closing their borders, even if we have a lot more of that rhetoric nowadays, but in stratifying access to citizenship, stratifying access to work permits, stratifying the capacity to live and build a viable life in the country that you were working with your family or those closest to you, and so on and so forth. And we're therefore producing a kind of rhetoric which was able to allow for, again, not just kind of nationalist affect, but an idea of we're in control of the ship and we know where it's going, at the same time as being able to benefit from cheap labor and benefit from the or not even just benefit from, but exist within the sort of open global deregulated capitalist economies within which nation states had invested themselves. So what this, sorry, lost my train of thought. You're going to have to cut there for a moment and join me back up to something else.
No, that's okay. That's fine. That's all part of the conversation. You were talking there about multiculturalism and the way in which, even when it works for capitalist economies in terms of having a relatively open labor market and plugging gaps in the labor market or tensions in the labor market through cheap reserve armies of labor, nevertheless is vulnerable to a critique by a nationalist rhetoric. What I would love to get you to tease out a wee bit is what nationalism is and what it's meant for you in terms of Ireland, Britain, the Nordic countries, places where you've lived.
Yeah, this is a great question, and I apologize in advance for the lack of coherence in my answer. I think because it's useful to start thinking of nationalism in terms of its incoherence, and I'm thinking here of a very 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 good book by a friend of mine, Siva Mohan Valuvan, called The Clamor of Nationalism. And the clamoring question is in his analysis, which is very much based on thinking about contemporary, you know, pre and post Brexit, but not only nationalism in the UK, is to understand it as clamorous, that there are a number of different, not just different interests, but different forces, different resources different imaginaries which are constantly reproducing nationalisms within what we often think about in the singular as nationalism, as an expression of fidelity to a naturally given relationship between a people, a territory, and the political institutions of a state. So I think that I find this way of thinking about its incoherence and the power of that incoherence as something which is quite persuasive. If I was to then try to think about that in terms of given locations, let me think about this now for a minute. Where would be kind of interesting to talk about? I mean, I could probably risk talking a little bit about Finland here, which is somewhere where I have, you know, lived on and off and taught and don't profess to be an expert on, but it's a place that I both love and that infuriates me in all kinds of ways, precisely because I think of the way in which nationalism is mediated and functions there. But my starting point would be to think about it in terms of that, you know, a structural feature of nationalism is to a large extent also a sense of exceptionality, right? And there are lots of ways in which this is very familiar to me as you know, somebody socialized in Ireland, where particular types of exceptionalism are reproduced around, or it's the claim to exceptionalism produces nationalism in particular ways. And this doesn't necessarily need to be integralist or reactionary. I'll give an example of this at the moment, where the Irish government, and this is one of the things that the departing Prime Minister Leo Varadkar did in his final address to the Council of Ministers in the European Union, he made a very interesting speech where he said, you know, we've made a big mistake in Europe in the way that we have dealt with the genocide in Gaza, and that most of the global south sees this as the expression of European double standards vis-a-vis the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that this is going to do untold damage into the future. And this sounds like a very progressive statement at the level of discourse, I guess it is. It's also part of a performance by a centre-right government in Ireland that Ireland is different when it comes to Gaza and Palestine. And at the level of political activism and civil society, in some ways it is. Every Saturday since the invasion of Gaza, there has been a substantial protest in Dublin and other cities and towns around Ireland. There's a level of popular sentiment and popular solidarity, which is very important. But it's also being used by the political class to produce a sense of exceptionality. And this was called out recently in the UN as a particular type of, you know, performing Irish exceptionality. We are the good ones on Gaza in the European Union. But when it comes to votes, when it comes to taking a political stand, when it comes to applying political pressure, all of that or a lot of that is absent. So it's rhetoric without any kind of political substance. And so, you know, that's a form of exceptionality, which I think can be seen in or as being produced within a sort of marketplace of national branding, a marketplace of national positionality, where, as we know, nationalism always looks for that exceptional genius and exceptional sense of what the people are. But this is something which is sort of, you know, hyper-ritualized in terms of contemporary diplomacy, branding, you know, the kind of corporate nature of national presentation. But there's the thing that I find to go back to, and I'm trying to choose my words kind of carefully here, interesting in contemporary Finland is that there's a mode of nationalism right now which is how would I say this again, you're going to have to do some editing here, Toby.
I don't edit, prof, so if you want to stop recording for a moment while you decide what you want to say, we can do that. Do you want to do that?
And will all of this be in now?
All of this will be in that's in now, but we can stop.
I'm so that's good. I'm so used to the over edited that now I have to get used to.
You know, one of the reasons why I started doing podcasts, prof, was that I got frustrated living in the US by the way in which national public radio was brilliantly produced but was contentless.
Yes. Okay.
I wanted to see more friction, lower production values.
Well, I mean, I suppose if I can get away with framing this as, you know, the struggle for thought in action, and therefore the friction that that involves, I'll try and do that. So
I
I'll
think
apologize for
it's
my humming
propaganda.
and hawing.
It's propaganda of the deed with an
With an with far too many ums. Let me try to let me try to therefore apologies for to listeners for assuming that the editing process would save me. Let me try to start somewhere else with this point then, which is to go back to your initial question. I had a second answer to that, which is perturbing or as well as enervating me at the moment. And the second answer to that was, and it's not unrelated to where I started, is the ease with which militarism has become a central facet of contemporary European nationalisms in the shadow of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which again is a very, very kind of complex subject to get into. But it's the extent to which there's the presentation of a path-dependent way of representing the nation as, and again, dependent on a notion of a failed past. You can see this with, for example, the French president Emmanuel Macron, who has gone from being, one could say, rather blasé about the Russian invasion to now positioning himself as the sort of yes, you know. Those of you who are listening can't see that Toby was just making boxing gestures there, which is a reference to Emmanuel Macron's comms team leaking pictures of him last week, looking very dedicated in the boxing gym, which is part of this production of the idea that he's a wartime leader. Right now, he's not a wartime leader. He's somebody who's very interested in putting pressure on the parties further to the right of him between now and the upcoming European elections. And we'll see what happens to his newfound dedication to Ukraine after that date. But what's interesting about the way in which this militarism is currently functioning is that it is based on a notion of a complacent past, a past which again was sort of, you know, weak, which allowed, you know, the military muscle and military vigor of European nations to be dissipated in a, you know, too much trust, too much cosmopolitanism, too much of these things that sort of distract us and make us weak. And it has been mainlined by politicians who don't really, to me, appear to be very, what's the word I would pick here, who don't appear to me to be very perturbed by the way in which they're talking about potential for war in 2024, potential for war in 2025, or whatever it might be. And so it kind of brings me back to some of the themes we were looking at about sort of noise in the public sphere. It's unclear to me whether this really constitutes a significant remilitarization of Europe, or whether and or to what extent and what proportion of this is a need to occupy the news cycle, a need to occupy public space, to perform certain kinds of political positionalities and certain kinds of political images, up to and including the idea that it is now the role of the nation to produce young soldiers and to increase its demographic output, i.e. have children, in order to guarantee the this is Macron again, guarantee the future virility of the nation, and so on and so forth. So within a very short space of time, there's been a turn to a kind of rhetoric which would not be out of place in late 19th century Europe. And it's the speed with which that has taken shape, and it's the speed with which that has been naturalized in certain public spheres around Europe that I find, you know, I find deeply perturbing, and wonder to what extent is it because the relationship between the referent of actual conflict and war and the utility of this rhetoric around militarization and the virility of the nation is just another way of performing, if you like, or just another way of providing a certain kind of nationalist enjoyment at a certain political moment. And I don't really have an answer to that. I don't do justice, of course, to the geopolitics of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in that answer either. But I think it's just one of the it gives some kind of sense of something that really interests me is the speed with which these things can happen, the speed with which they can become a certain kind of common sense, the speed with which certain sorts of media outlets and political parties and think tanks are speaking a very, very similar language, creating a certain center of gravity around a new consensus or a new reality, which I think an awful lot of people would find deeply, deeply alienating and troubling.
I wonder whether some of this is about an axis of imperialism, whether that's a nostalgia for imperialism or a celebration of freeing from its bonds, freeing oneself from its bonds. So if you think of the major European imperial powers of yore, France, Belgium, Germany, the Netherlands, Britain, Italy, to a certain extent, Sweden, and so on, they still have within them strong elements of nostalgia for their self-importance. And of course, they continue to be imperial powers, probably most importantly France, in terms of its sense of an entitlement to intervene, in inverted commas, wherever and whenever it wants in its former territories, versus countries where the struggle for independence, for nationalism, which is clearly the case in Ireland, but obviously outside Europe is very much the case in really the whole of Africa, much of Asia, the whole of Latin America, where that struggle is never forgotten and is ever present and sometimes feels as though it's an incomplete project. And one could say the same of Eastern and Central European countries emerging from a Soviet orbit. So for me, there, you know, one reason why this thing can happen very quickly, the rapidity to which you refer, is that there is a post-imperial nostalgia and a post-imperial fear and desire for self-assertion on both sides of that axis.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's also the post-imperial anxieties, of course, were heavily invested over the last few years in projects of reproducing innocence, projects of having and holding. So I'm thinking here, of course, about the various symbolic, not just symbolic, but very real controversies over statues and the sort of, on the one hand, the sort of Confederate inheritance in the United States, but the way that that played out as a consequence of the sort of not just travel, but translation of Black Lives Matter activism into, you know, a full on. And of course, we had this with Rhodes Must Fall even before that in South Africa, but a full on sort of and very, very properly confrontational public politics of disassembling the colonial heritage, starting by pointing out its existence, its absolute centrality to port cities, to big imperial cities and so on, but also contesting its innocence and its presence in public space. So I think that contestation, of course, fueled in all of the countries that you mentioned, fueled a particular type of backlash, but it was not one, I think, which was particularly centrally tapped into at the level of elite politics, but it certainly dominated an awful lot of these sort of, as we were talking about earlier, these kind of quite repetitive spectacles which produce certain kinds of enjoyment, which are just, you know, the grammar of them, the script of them is very easy to mediate. It's very easy to sort of point to the cast of characters, this, you know, the innocent colonial historians and the woke historians over here, or there's the young people, you know, with purple hair over here versus, you know, the ordinary people over here who just like their statues, all of that kind of stuff. It's just, it can be reproduced and constantly reproduced in all sorts of ways. But there's definitely been a shift from that moment where that sort of, you know, a sense of imperial entitlement or whatever we might want to call it was vested in conservation, and now moving into a sense of repositioning those nations which have the right to bestride the world, repositioning them at a moment where, as you rightly point out, I mean, I think the thing that was interesting about Varadkar's comment, even if it was to some extent a cover for a lack of Irish political real agency or Irish government agency on this question, is it pointed to something which I think may turn out to be very, very profound in the years to come, which is that in large parts of the world, and those large parts of the world which have been colonized, what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Gaza looks That's what it is, that it's colonization, it's settler colonialism, which is now engaged in a phase of genocidal extermination and reclaiming of or claiming of land. That's clearly what that is, as viewed from large parts of the world, other than this kind of shrinking parts of Europe and North America, which holds to the idea that it is within their gift to decide how this conflict will be mediated and how it will work out in favor of their starting point being the defense of the only democracy in the Middle East, and so on and so forth. So I think that's you're right to point to a certain difference in the way in which this politics works out in Ireland. I think the one thing that I would add, and I think it's important, and it's also important because I know so many people who give so much of themselves to this, that one of the reasons for this post-colonial solidarity in Ireland is real political work, is constant political work, rather than, if you like, some kind of noises in the blood that just sort of produce, produce the right attitude on difficult questions. It's very much a consequence of social movements, of organization, which have kept Palestinian solidarity central to the public and political agenda for years and years and years, in ways that then allow for certain kinds of sympathies to be expressed in these terms.
Prof, I've got two final questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything to what we've discussed as a way of concluding our conversation. Does that sound all right?
It sounds great.
You must be tired by now, because
No, I'm not. I'm just
quarter of an
trying to.
hour
I'm just trying to
after
think of all the things that I
that you
left
left
hanging
out.
there.
Well, after the quarter of an hour of therapizing, you were then denied the opportunity to edit any missteps you may have made, whereas my life consequential missteps were not recorded. So the first of these two final queries, Prof. G, is to ask you about public service media, a topic about which you've written a great deal, but which we haven't touched on today. Well, we've mentioned the BBC a couple of times, but we've talked a lot about the commercial media, and we've talked a lot about things that aren't directly related to communications infrastructures and so on. I wondered if you could give us a sense of what public service media are and what they're likely to be.
You keep the easiest questions for the end, for the encore and the exit. Well, the short answer is I don't know, and the long answer is probably something like that too. But I think, well, I was at a very interesting discussion, as I mentioned, I think at the start of this, about the way that, public service broadcasters can parlay the fact that they're under pressure from both sides into evidence that they're doing something good. And but some of the other perspectives in that discussion were quite interesting, which is that people were kind of very convinced historically of the importance of public service broadcasting, asking themselves, really, is there anything that we can still defend in some of these institutions? Now, this varies hugely by
Right.
context, as you know. I mean, I would definitely make up for the fact that I promised some devastating content on Finland earlier and then dropped it to go and talk about something else. I'll try to make up for that by saying now at this late stage that when you take a public service broadcaster like Yle, YLE in Finland, it is. Would seem to be in all kinds of ways, although I would have many criticisms of its political journalism, particularly in this particular moment and in a context where they have a very extreme government, that in many people's consciousness still seems to have come out of nowhere almost. But as a public service media entity in the Nordic countries and some other places, they have navigated this shift towards the digital in ways that are, creative and sustainable by comparison with things that have happened in Britain, Ireland, or elsewhere. I think to get to the meat of the question, which is what could public service media be? It's very, very clear that if we were to think about designing something called public service media today from scratch, it wouldn't mean bricks and mortar institutions of the classic modern kind that took shape from the 1920s in radio and 1940s and 50s television onwards, mainly in Western Europe, but with influence on the shape of media institutions elsewhere. I think we would be looking at public forms of public infrastructure that can disseminate a really radical plurality of content, that can give proper access to the diversity and divergence and antagonistic divergence of political and social voices that exist within a given country, and that would move away from the idea that their job is at some level to, you know, represent the nation back to itself, which is always going to, you know, always going to tend towards a particularly sort of bourgeois representation of the nation and a tendency to look to unify, where in fact, I mean, and I think this is something which is heightened at the moment, where there is so much fear of notions of polarization and so on and so forth. But I think it would be much better to think about how can we develop systems that can work with the media content, which is being constantly produced by all kinds of producers and people at any given moment, that can have more democratic. And this is where I think a book from quite a few years ago at this point, by Dan Hind about rediscovering the public was really interesting, about what kind of radical kind of democratic systems could be brought to bear on the idea on program making, on editorial decision making, on what it is that people think they need reflected back to them in their own societies and so own lives and so on and so forth. So there's lots excuse me, of very good proposals out there for what public service media could be and how it could harness the digital to do that. But I think what's very clear is that this is not going to happen politically, or this will not happen outside of very, very significant radical political change in, for example, the United Kingdom or Ireland, or where public service broadcasting in Ireland is in all kinds of chaos and all kinds of crisis over the last few years, which would take an entire other podcast for me to hum and haw my way through. So I think there's a way in which we have to, you know, get real about what's possible in terms of the radical reform of public service media, because it's not going to happen outside of or separate from much more significant political change, I would say. That's question one.
Question two, Prof, is I'm a biochemist. I'm a neoclassical economist. I'm a Chicago school lawyer. I'm on a committee evaluating Professor Titley's application to become All High, etc., of Maynooth. And my combined subjectivity is posing this query to you. How do you know what you know?
Ooh, I like this. As posed by Trinity Minha, right? At a certain point, I remember when that question was reflexive and radical, but now the combined subjectivities that are posing it to me are also subjectivities that, in asking that question, are not saying you obviously, but would not be all that interested, because one of the things which is happening right now, of course, is that this question is being posed politically to arts and humanities and social science research in all kinds of ways, across Europe in all kinds of increasingly sort of virulent ways. Not just how do you know what you know, but also what you know isn't real science, isn't real knowledge. It's just activism. It's just, you know, it's just reproducing theoretical orthodoxies and all of the rest of it. So that's the political economy in which this question is being posed right now. There's a number of ways in which people answer this. One is to purify their disciplines and to present them as nothing but the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. Another is to appeal to application and the relevance and so on and so forth. But the question you posed was to me personally, and how do I know what I know? I know what I know because I read, I talk to people, I doubt myself. When I read what I've written previously, as I tried to do for this podcast, I wonder, did I actually write that? Because I don't think like that anymore, or that was really good. I wouldn't be capable of writing that paragraph right now. So I know what I know through just kind of quite boring and conventional answers, but through application and self-doubt, and through a, I suppose, a sort of somewhat Catholic methodological sensibility also, that I'm not allergic to, clearly, as you know, to sort of take a sort of stereotype of the theorist, I'm clearly not allergic to the empirical or to data. And it's something that, of course, been quite involved in empirical studies over the years. But nor do I think that they make much sense of the world without being clear about the interpretative frameworks and being clear about the antagonisms between the interpretive frameworks that we bring to bear on them. Yeah. Wow,
Congratulations for
I
this.
should write this method down and practice it
Yeah.
more.
Well, no, the Trinitarian reactionary in front of you grants you your pay rise.
I thought they were just going to grant me a continued right to exist, which I was going to settle for, so.
No, something much more important. So, Prof, to finish off, I wonder if there are things that we've not discussed that you'd like to talk about, or topics we have touched on where there's more you'd like to say. For example, whether or not Sana Marin is the best strategic counselor in the history of the Tony Blair Institute.
Well, I mean, she seems to be she seems to be doing very well there, from what Instagram tells me. Yes.
Are there things you'd like to add, Prof?
Let's think. Is there any? Is there if there's anyone still if there's anyone still listening to me? I'm sending out psychic queries. Is there anything that I should double back on, in terms of thinking about the themes that we're looking at? I mean, we could talk a little bit more about the freedom of speech stuff if we wanted to, in slightly more technical or more less overtly politicized terms, which is where I was positioning the discussion at the start, because of course it's the political problematics that within which freedom of speech is being invoked that I've found most interesting. But to maybe one of the things that I would like to say about it is, or how I'm approaching the problem right now, is that the, as I said, there's a sort of, it's fascinating that we have so much talk about crises of freedom of speech and people being silenced and freedom of speech in danger or in peril in contexts of sort of abundant speech like this. I mean, think how many people like me are waffling their way through a podcast on a given day, and you know, we know that we have abundant speech out there, and yet we also have a crisis of speech. And this is what I've been trying to think through in also in somewhat less polemical terms. And that is that if there that there may well be a crisis of freedom of speech, but it's not the crisis that people point to when they talk about cancellation or silencing. Even if these things are, you know, I don't buy the idea that unless a state is involved in censorship, that there's some form of coercion, not ha that what happens doesn't matter or can't be coercive or can't be sort of have vicious consequences in people's lives. That I take for granted. But I think there are always, if we think about the way the freedom of speech is traditionally justified, like what does it do? There are moral arguments for human autonomy. So it is always the case that people's expression as part of their rights, as part of their existence, the moral autonomy to speak is always under threat, always and ever, in ways that mutate, in ways that sometimes stay the same, in ways that involve overt repression, and in ways that involve more subtle forms of marginalization, and so on and so forth. So I don't see a crisis there that isn't always present, that people are always being silenced in that way. And we can look at, for example, you know, not people, not sort of New York Times columnists claiming to be silenced, but the actual silencing of Palestinian journalists, silencing up until death, which happens and never gets connected to debates about freedom of speech, which is one of the things that, you know, does inflame my passions on this question. But the other justification for freedom of speech is consequentialist, as we know, that it does things, that it produces public reason, or that it enhances democracy, or that it's crucial to the production of knowledge, to avoiding sort of, you know, bankrupt orthodoxies, and so on and so forth. And that's where I do think there is a crisis, because I think the consequentialist investment in speech, and this we talked about briefly at the start, is something which is in crisis. In democracies, as you pointed out very eloquently, Toby, in terms of how we think about public sphere formation, in terms of how we think about the relationship between information and knowledge, all of these kinds of questions. There's absolutely a consequentialist crisis of freedom of speech and expression. But that's not something I think that we're going to be able to map, never mind intervene in, by constantly posing the questions through these frameworks of a crisis of freedom of speech, which are not just out there in the public sphere, but also quite dominant in the way in which academic discourse sort of approaches it. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get away from and say, well, I think there might be a crisis, but it's not that one. It's the one where speech doesn't do the things that we've become accustomed to claiming in its name.
Absolutely. And the way in which it's invoked so mightily in the United States as, in a sense, the most important part of the Constitution.
Yes.
Again and again and again, in the service of all sorts of different interests, shows us that it is the notion of speech as much as speech itself that becomes consequential here.
Yes.
And formative, also formative, and rarely understood. Take very stupid people regarded as brilliant like Elon Musk, as never being deemed absolute in any legal jurisdiction, in any philosophical discussion, in any family. It is conditioned by limits. It is a kind of J.S. Mill idea.
Yes.
And if you go back to Milton and the Area Pacitica, none of that was meant to apply to Catholics. They weren't allowed to speak, for example. Yeah. They had no rights. They were the devil.
I mean, this part of the heritage, I think, is, I mean, I think there's often a way in which people speak about the sort of philosophical heritage of freedom of speech, which just sort of pulls things from their context and treats them as sort of timeless aphorisms that just tell us why speech is important. And one of the things that it does, and what you really point to in the context of Mill, most obviously, but also Milton, is that this is something that Alan Hayworth argued in his really brilliant book on Mill from the 90s, is that Mill's arguments, like the arguments of most philosophers concerned with freedom of speech, were formed in the context of an argument. And that argument was about what was happening politically or socially at that point in time. So it does them an enormous disservice to treat them as sort of T-shirts, to, you know, slogans to put on T-shirts. So there's also, I mean, there's a reproduction of knowledge around freedom of speech, which is part of the problem as well. And of course, there's an idealist orientation in these arguments, which means that we do tend to often debate the big ideas and then look at how they, you know, can be made sense of or applied in society. But it's important, I think, to be aware of the complexity of the inheritance of these discussions, which is left out of this kind of sloganeering. So the question for me is precisely that. Nobody lives a state of absolute freedom of speech in any capacity in their lives. So how does it make sense to rally politically around this idea? And where has that come from? And why does that appear to be the sort of maximalist horizon which must be appealed to in order to, you know, sort of prove your fidelity to the idea? There's a kind of strange identity politics, to use that dreadful term, at play here, which is that unless I tell you that my fidelity to this notion is maximalist, everything else is just cowardly or relativist or whatever it might be. And yet that makes no sense when we think about just everyday speech, never mind the regulation, institutionalization, political economy of communication.
When you made the point, Prof, about the idea of the complaint from the right being about a negation, a sublation of the natural state of things, namely the satisfaction of individual desires, that I think gets to the nub of the Isaiah Berlin distinction between positive and negative freedom, understood by him as negative freedom being, in a sense, the Millian ideal and his idea, freedom from being prevented from doing blah, blah, and blah, versus the positive freedom, the freedom to. And, of course, Foucault problematizes that distinction very ably. But for me, it's still a useful binary, because one of the things that it makes clear to me is that the adoration of the defense of negative freedom by the right naturally has its limits in terms of people being able to become what they want to become. And when it reaches those limits, when it's at the point where it needs to jump over into positive freedom, what it does instead is to crap on about how I would be able to be X, Y, and Z. I'm prevented by you. And I'm prevented by you in the form of speech or culture or whatever. To me, that's the switching point.
Yeah.
And that's where we are at the moment in terms of the far right in Latin America, in Europe, Western Europe, in Eastern and Central Europe, and in the United States. The places that I perhaps know rather better than others, than other, not than other people, but than other parts of the world. That's what I think is going on here. So, for what it's worth.
No, I think you're right, and I think it's an intensification of a. Of, I mean, I think you. One of the things that I think is important about, you know, Milton's "It Doesn't Apply to Catholics" is that this is this and this is something that can be found in you know, or sort of pointed to by Spinoza as well, is that very often what prevents one's speech is the speech of others, in all kinds of ways. And therefore, one of the paradoxes of claims to freedom of speech is that speech must be removed in order for my speech to be free. And that very quickly becomes a kind of infrastructure for sort of the sort of resentment and negation that you're talking about here in a public media space where it simply doesn't make sense to point to something and say, well, that's the thing which is keeping me quiet. But it does it in terms of the level of you know, enjoyment and these ideas that we were looking at earlier. But it is it's a trick. It's a tricky question to think through in a public sphere where I think one of the things that is interesting in these debates is it's not just that people disagree with each other. They disagree on the very basis on which disagreements can be had. So in other words, up to and including what constitutes speech and how it should be thought about. And this is what goes on within hate speech debates, for example, is on the one hand, you get a strange, you know, you talked about this sort of absolutist approach to speech. Within that, you get all kinds of paradoxes. And one of them is the idea that speech is priceless, right? Speech must be our primary fidelity is to the free flow of speech. But it's not just priceless, it's also costless. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't have consequences. It doesn't, you know, it can't hurt anybody or it can't do anything in the world. And this contradiction is never resolved. It's simply sort of bypassed. And it comes up against people who are mobilized around other theories of speech, which have their problems, particularly the way hate speech is often understood, but which say, no, actually, it does something not in the world, but it does something in my world. And I don't have to listen to it, or I'm going to take the following steps to push back against it, or whatever it might be. And I think that's one of the reasons why many of the discussions, you know, many of the kind of controversies that flow through the idea of freedom of speech are not really about freedom of speech at all, in some ways. They're about conditions of public participation, where publics have become a little bit more pluralistic, a little bit more chaotically and contingently open to different voices in politics, but where structural, media, political, economic power has not changed all of that much. But it's much harder to exist in the public sphere today and not be pushed back against at some level. And I think that's driving a lot of this sort of, you know, fury around freedom of speech. But much of it has got to do with the speech bit as well, right? What do we actually mean by speech and communication? What's its significance, and who gets to decide that?
Prof. Gavin Titley, aka Titley of Maynooth, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. As you say, maybe three people and a dog have fallen asleep, but I certainly haven't.
Me neither, and really the dog is definitely, the dog is awake, but it's the people. Well, let's see.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Gavin.
Thank you so much, Toby.